Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much, everyone, for being here with us again this Sunday. Today we're going to talk about some local news, specifically with Erin O'Hare. She's the equity reporter for Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find Erin's articles and other articles at cvilletomorrow.org. Erin joined Charlottesville Tomorrow as equity reporter in March of 2021, but has a career in Charlottesville that goes back 5 years with Seville Weekly. Welcome, Erin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's always nice to learn, go deep in the weeds in some of the material that not everyone wants to sit in on these meetings of the city council meeting with the planning commissioners, school board, and all these other smaller groups where if you don't have a vested interest, sometimes you can doze off. But I guess we all have a vested interest that we may not be paying attention to. So I appreciate you coming to help us learn things.
I'm happy to do it. And, you know, I don't always want to watch these meetings either, but you're right that they are very important. But it is hard to find the time. These meetings are going for 5, 6, 7 hours these days. So folks who have maybe multiple jobs or have children or just need time to themselves can't always tune in.
But I have to ask at the start, equity reporter. I'm not sure that I understand that title, you know, journalist, but equity reporter, what's the official designation / definition?
Sure. So a pretty basic definition is, you know, you can kind of compare it to equality, right? So if equality, everyone is treated the same way, no matter their differences. But equity is, you know, it means that everyone is provided with what they need to succeed. So that means that different people need different things to succeed, right? You know, some folks might be food insecure. So what can we do to make sure that they have food that other people have easy access to? And so with equity, I'm looking at a lot of issues that affect people who are low income, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color in our community who are typically underserved and underrepresented. And, you know, housing is a major part of that for me, especially right now as we're talking about the Future Use Land Map. But does that definition of equity kind of make sense?
Yes, that helps me understand that a little better.
Good.
And hopefully the listeners as well.
Yes.
So let's start one. Yeah, I believe it's two separate articles that you have posted on cvilletomorrow.org within the last several weeks, month, on the future land use map.
Oh, yeah.
So you say that with a sound of excitement. So future land use map, first explain that, define that.
Sure. So the future land use map is one component of one chapter of Charlottesville City's comprehensive plan update. And every locality in Virginia, every county, every independent city has to update its comprehensive plan every 5 years. That's mandated by the Commonwealth's law. And so Charlottesville started, I mean, they're basically always kind of working on an update, right? Because 5 years in city government isn't really a long time. Things move slowly a bit. So Charlottesville's comp plan is actually overdue because back in 2018, I believe it was, the Thomas Jefferson Planning District released a study about the housing situation in Charlottesville. And we've known anecdotally that Charlottesville has become a very expensive place to live. We hear that all the time from our neighbors, on social media and the news. But this report really showed how bad the situation was and continues to get. So basically the city said, oh, we really need to take a harder look at this. And so they delayed the comprehensive plan update so that they could have more time to look effectively at an affordable plan and how to incorporate policies to hopefully build more affordable housing in Charlottesville into the comprehensive plan. So for the last like 5 or so years, they've been working on this affordable housing plan, on figuring out how we can, you know, have incentives for building new affordable housing or converting, you know, current buildings into housing. So they're working with consultants, Roadside and Harwell Inc. out of DC. They're award-winning urban planners. And the city's hired them to help with the comp plan update, particularly the land use and, you know, kind of housing chapter. And the future land use map is a really important component of that because it gives sort of a guide for how the city could go about building more housing or creating more housing. It's just a guide. It's not a policy. It just says this is what is possible in these places around town. And of course, they consider a variety of factors when putting that together. How many people already live there? How accessible is it? Is it close to downtown? Is there a bus stop? Is there already a lot of traffic here? Do we have more density here? Where could we put new things? So that's all considered in the what could go where aspect. And then that future land use map, whenever it is approved, which I think it will be soon, by the Planning Commission, it goes up to City Council, who would then approve it. And from there, the future land use map would guide the rezoning process. And that would be the next step in this process, a zoning rewrite. And that will be more contentious than the future land use map process, which is almost unbelievable because the future land use map process has been pretty contentious. People get, you know, someone told me, the fangs really come out when you start talking about this sort of thing in anywhere, but in Charlottesville too.
So if what I heard or thought I heard was the Planning Commission and the City Council have to come sort of some general agreement.
Correct.
And then that has to move on to the zoning that also has to have an agreement. Do these groups have the same goals?
Yes. From what I understand, generally, they do. Everyone, or the general idea is that City Council wants to make Charlottesville more affordable for more people, and the Planning Commission wants the same.
But you didn't say that the zoning committee had that goal.
Well, the zoning is the next step, and that is also a goal of the zoning process as well. The zoning is so granular, it's almost a lot-by-lot look. But I think that, you know, the goal of how can we create more affordable housing with the future land use map, as well as other policies, right? The map itself is not going to create affordable housing on its own. So it's one tool And then the zoning map will be another tool, incentives for developers and, you know, homeowners to maybe build an accessory dwelling unit, like a cottage that's affordable. All of those things have to work together. And there are many more, of course, in order to see if we can get more and more affordable housing here.
Erin O'Hare from Charlottesville Tomorrow with us at the moment. We talk about local news and some of her articles and information that we need to be more aware of. And we're starting with the future land use map. Erin, is this a big not in my backyard issue
with
specific residents?
It is, yes. So not in my backyard, for folks who aren't aware, the shortening of that is NIMBY. And then on the other side, you've got the yes in my backyard, or the YIMBYs. And there's definitely conflict between the two groups. Some of the folks in town who are wealthier individuals who own their homes in historically wealthier neighborhoods around town don't want their neighborhoods to change. They like it. It works for them. You know, I can't speak for them, of course, but from what I've heard in public comment meetings, you know, they don't want more, they don't really want more people in their neighborhoods. They're saying, like, I support affordable housing, but not in my neighborhood. But their neighborhoods historically have not been affected by population growth in Charlottesville. The ones that have are actually historically low income and historically Black neighborhoods, because they're very close to UVA Hospital, for example, which has just expanded so much in recent decades. Or they're closer to just the university in general, or to downtown. And, you know, we've had so many different industries coming to town to, you know, start their business here or to expand. So,
well, can I ask a question?
Oh, sure.
So if the area of town that hasn't seen the growth, is that because the zoning doesn't allow for that? Because the homeowners regularly say, we don't want you to zone it for that?
Well, my understanding is that in the past, it has been that way. So yes, the zoning is part of that, is part of the reason why, right? Most of Charlottesville is zoned for quote unquote single family residents. So a home that is one complete building. It's not a duplex or a triplex. So most of Charlottesville is that, but that's not affordable for most people. And so that's true that the zoning is a component. And then in the past, I'm still, you know, this is my first go round with a comprehensive plan, but from what I've heard from folks who've been around for a while longer is that yes, people say, I don't want things to change. And, you know, they've been listened to. So that's part of how we got in this situation. Yeah.
Have these public input meetings been contentious, not contentious?
They've been extremely contentious. I would actually, sometimes it's gotten downright nasty. I will say that watching these meetings doesn't always make me feel good about my neighbors, not my neighbors like immediately, but the community in general. You know, you just kind of see, or you hear folks yelling at one another, saying things like, I worked so hard for my home just because someone else hasn't worked hard. Why should they benefit from all this? Which isn't really true. Plenty of people work hard and could never own a home for a number of reasons. And there's also a lot of misinformation going around that heightens the emotions in these meetings. You know, in a rezoning, you know, the city just, that's okay, this is what you can do here, but it's still up to individual property owners to build on their property. So sure, your neighbor could build, you know, a second, maybe, structure on their property, but they could probably do that anyway, right? So it really does come down to what the owners of property want to do. And that, of course, is different when it's an individual than it is a developer. So there's a lot of fear that developers will buy up land, knock down existing homes, put up huge structures. And I understand that fear. But from what I hear from the experts on this, the people who have done planning in the past, the people who have done zoning rewrites in the past, those things don't happen very often. And it's certainly not automatic. The change might be drastic in the document, in the policy, but it's not going to transform overnight before our eyes. The physical change is going to take a long time. And it takes a really long time between, you know, it takes a long time to get something built on your property. There are so many steps you got to go through. So it's, yes, a lot of misinformation, a lot of fears that are understandable. But also, one of the things about the public comment period, sort of as we talked about at the beginning, right, that these meetings are really long. And so that means that a lot of folks who do work multiple jobs, who maybe don't have an internet connection, or who are trying to put their kids to bed while this is going on, or any number of things, those folks can't tune into these meetings all the time. They don't have the ability to comment in this way. So what we're seeing in these meetings is an overwhelming majority of commenters are homeowners. Many of them are, you know, on the wealthy side, and they tend to have the time to be able to put into advocating for their own positions. Whereas there are a lot of folks in our community who just do not have that time because they're trying to survive.
Is there a method or a way for those folks to get their voice heard, or is it happening in a manner that's not at the streamed commission meeting?
Yeah. So because this has been going on for a while, there have been many other methods for people to comment. Obviously the pandemic changed the whole plan for how the consultants would do community outreach. They couldn't really go door to door safely. They couldn't really hold, you know, big community meetings indoors. So when everything moved online, yes, it did certainly kind of change the balance of who could comment. But the consultants, there's this Seaville Plans Together initiative, and that's the consultants, a community steering committee, members of the Planning Commission and City Council, Neighborhood Development Services, just representatives from around the community who are, you know, they're kind of tasked with being present in their like micro communities around town, listening and bringing that back to the table. So yeah, people could email, people could talk in person, people could schedule individual phone calls for other times. There have been efforts to reach out to other folks. But you know, some folks say that that hasn't been enough, that the voices that we typically don't reach out to are still not being heard.
Erin O'Hare with us today, equity reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can read articles at seavilletomorrow.org. Let's take our first break. We'll be right back and talk about some more of these articles that Erin has brought to light. Hang tight. And back with Erin O'Hare here, Charlottesville Tomorrow, seavilletomorrow.org. Erin, so we were talking about future land use map. One last question on this topic for now. Have there been any comments on regulating the landlords in the student areas? Because I would think that there are a lot of comments about this growth in housing around the university. You made mention of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Lots of comments around the university area that are negatively affecting the neighborhoods because the houses and the lawns and the parking aren't always kept up to the best of their abilities. Mm-hmm. And I would think that brings in a lot of negative thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. So has there been any comments on the landlords in those areas?
Yes, and it really differs neighborhood to neighborhood. What we're hearing from, say, folks in Lewis Mountain, they are worried that, or they don't want more students in to be moving in and making the neighborhood look messy. That's just what I've heard. That is not what I have seen or experienced. I don't live in Lewis Mountain. But then on the other hand, you know, you have Fifeville, which is a historically Black, used to be low income neighborhood, much in contrast to Lewis Mountain, which is majority white, wealthy folks. But in Fifeville, you have a lot of, you know, nurses, doctors, med students buying homes in that area so that they can walk to work. And that brings up property values, which increases property taxes, which means that families who are lower income can't afford to live there anymore, even though their families maybe have lived there for decades. So the concerns about growth with UVA really are so different neighborhood to neighborhood. There's been some talk about allowing for more density directly around UVA so that developers and landlords directly next to the university, which actually includes my neighborhood, would be incentivized to build more closer to UVA so that students don't spill out into other neighborhoods as much, that maybe they'd rather rent an apartment, you know, on JPA than live in a house in Belmont and have to commute over to the school. So that's another component of the students' conversation for sure.
Okay. So let's move on to a different article that you'd written about Midway Manor.
Yes.
Which is somewhat attached to this because it's still affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So tell us about Midway Manor as a complex.
Sure. So as you said, the situation at Midway Manor is very much related to the future use land map, the rezoning, and the comprehensive plan. So Midway Manor, for anyone who's listening who's not familiar, it is located technically at 100 Ridge Street. Excuse me, but what it is it's kind of on the corner of Ridge and South Street. So if you're at the intersection going from West Main into downtown, you cross Ridge McIntyre and you have that Lewis and Clark building, the apartment building directly in front of you, and the road kind of makes a V. If you stay to the right and you're on that one way, Midway Manor is to the right. And it's a four-story brick building finished in 1981. It's covered by a lot of bushes. So it is actually really easy to miss. But that building, since 1981, has been subsidized by HUD with a Section 8 contract. So the folks in that building are... it's for seniors and folks with disabilities on limited incomes. So, you know, say the rent is, we'll just pick $1,000 a month. But this person who's living on a fixed income, be it Social Security, disability, maybe they can't afford $1,000 a month. Most folks in that situation can't afford $1,000 a month. So if they get, you know, this type of housing voucher, the government, HUD, the what is it? The Office of Housing and Urban Development, federal office, they will subsidize that rent. So say a person could pay $200 a month. They pay $200 a month and HUD would pay the remaining $800 a month. So that's how it's been at Midway Manor for 40 years since it was built. And that contract expires this year. And in that building, we've got about 100 apartments. So a little more than 100, or a few more than 100 citizens, people who are, as I said, elderly and or someone with a disability. So the building is not in great shape. The elevators keep breaking. Like, I mean, almost every day, multiple times a week at least, I'm getting notes from residents there saying the elevator's down again. The elevator's down again. This isn't working. Elevator's down, which is not acceptable for people who have disabilities or mobility challenges, right? I've heard stories from people who experience this about, you know, they live on the fourth floor. Both elevators are down, but they can't walk. How can they get down four flights of stairs to get their heart medication out of their mailbox? They have to ask someone. Or one woman crawled up and down the stairs to get her medication out of her mailbox. And residents are frustrated. They want answers from the owner of the building, which is a private owner. And so I've done a few different stories kind of looking into how this works, and sort of how they're being treated, how the building's being treated. So the contract expired this year. The owners just signed a new contract with HUD for 2 years, which is great for the next 2 years, but these people who live here, many who have, you know, lived there for a decade, some even longer, if the owners of Midway Manor do not extend that contract beyond those 2 years, these folks will have to find another place to live, which, as we just discussed with the affordable housing or the housing market the way that it is here, many of these folks will not be able to afford to stay living in Charlottesville. They might have to go out to the county or further out into other counties. There's a chance that some of them might become homeless. And that's just, I mean, it's just unacceptable. A lot of these people have given the community a lot. They're older, they've worked hard, they're retired. Some of them, you know, have cancer and other diseases that they didn't choose or do anything to get. And so the question there is, you know, it's like, what is the community going to do for these folks? Will something like the affordable housing strategy that City Council is trying to implement with that future land use map? This is exactly the situation that a really good policy in that way could help.
Let me ask you a question about this, because I read your article again. You can go to seavilletomorrow.org. You can look for specific articles. You can search Midway Manor. You can find Erin as a specific journalist and search articles under her name. This one on Midway Manor. This article said that the inspections, you're saying that the elevators were out regularly, along with other problems happening regularly. But the article also said that inspections had recently taken place.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming had passed.
Yes. So what, how is that possible? Is that the question?
I guess that's the last phrase that I didn't throw out there, but yes.
Yeah. You know what, Rick? I'm wondering the same thing. And I'm trying to find that out. That is hopefully the next story that I will publish. I don't understand how the building can pass an inspection with the elevators in the condition that they are. So I am trying to find out what the what the inspection report is, what they're looking for. I know that the elevators themselves get inspected by an independent company, and that company has also passed the elevators in the inspection. I don't know why. I'm trying to find out. That's harder because they're a private company. So there's someone would have to willingly give me the reports, which is not likely. Whereas with HUD, because those are federal, that's a federal office. Those are public documents. I can request those. But it often takes a while, but I have no idea how the building passes inspections with the elevators in the condition that they are. People have been stuck on those elevators. The other day, someone fell off the elevator because it stopped 6 inches above the floor. And she was all bruised and sore the next day. I'm wondering the same thing, and I'm trying really hard to find an answer because, you know, why is that allowed? And, you know, the question is, should there be a better policy for that? So that people don't have to be afraid to ride the elevator or afraid to leave their apartment. And if it's happening at Midway Manor, it's got to be happening in other places too, right?
Well, is it, and I feel like I'm just taking some political stance here when I'm not trying to, but, but I don't know what else to say. Is it happening because of the type of building that it is and the people that it's servicing?
I mean, that's a really valid question. And I wonder the same thing. It certainly could be a factor in that our society in general doesn't have a lot of respect for elderly folks, for people with disabilities, I should say seniors, for folks with disabilities or for low income people, right? Those are folks who are often getting, screwed over, for lack of a better term. And the other component also that people have talked about and are concerned about is that land is prime real estate in Charlottesville. It is right off the downtown mall. It is, it's a great location. And people have been worried that the owners are purposefully letting the building fall into disrepair so that people will want to move out, or so that, they don't want to make any repairs because they know they're going to sell it in a couple years for a major profit. But I've never spoken with the owners. They haven't returned any of my phone calls or emails for months. So I don't know what their thought process is, but I do know that that is something that people are worried about, that it's purely a business transaction. A lot of residents have said to me, something to the effect of, we are just money in their pockets. They don't feel like they're being seen as people who have homes in this building. So it's, it's a hard situation.
Well, I hope you'll keep us up to date.
Yeah, I will.
On what's going on at Midway Manor. Mm-hmm. Again, Erin O'Hare with us today, a reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow, as we talk about some local news and several of the articles that she has written over the last month. So, Erin, let's get started on it. Actually, you know what? We're going to jump, since it's not much time left till our next break. Let's do something real quick. Let's talk about the neglected cemetery.
Oh, yeah.
Do that real quick.
Oh, gosh. I loved reporting this story. I mean, I love reporting all of my stories. My favorite part of my whole job is getting to go and meet people and talk with them and get to know them. So I've known about Daughters of Zion for a while. It's one of the first, if not the first, like official African-American cemetery in town. It opened just a few years after the Civil War ended. And it became the burial place for many prominent Black families in Charlottesville from the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s up through the early 20th century. By about the 1930s, the group that had established the cemetery, the Daughters of Zion, they weren't really active anymore. Folks who had been taking care of the cemetery had died or moved away, and it just really fell into disrepair, into neglect. The cemetery is right near Oakwood, so it is right downtown. It used to be separated from Oakwood by just a wall. Now there's a wall and a road, and there's a Jewish cemetery right there as well. So you have these three, different cemeteries. And let's see, I was told by one of the preservers of the cemetery, Bernadette Hammond Whitsett, or Whitsett Hammond, Bernadette Whitsett Hammond, that when she was a little girl, she remembered going to the cemetery, but they had to bring sickles to clear out the brush to get to their ancestors' graves. So it was really overgrown and like you said, neglected. So in 2015, Bernadette and Edwina St. Rose, they both have ancestors buried in Daughters of Zion. They and a few other folks got together and said, you know what, we really need to preserve the cemetery. This is such an important part of local history and it's being neglected. The city had taken over ownership at some point, but wasn't really doing any work on it. And so they got together, they got some money from city council to clean the cemetery, to start learning about the people who are buried there. So far, they've counted, there's about 140 grave markers. So there's, more than 140 people buried there because you have a couple different people on the headstones and whatnot. And so they know that there are about, more than 150 people buried there, but a recent radar scan showed that there are actually more than 300 graves in the cemetery, which is way more than markers. So they've been
That's amazing.
It is, isn't it? And so they're trying to, kind of uncover the stories of the people they know are buried there while also trying to find out who is buried there who doesn't have a marker.
Again, our guest today, Erin O'Hare from Charlottesville Tomorrow. So let's take our next break. We'll come back and we're going to talk about some exciting events down at Charlottesville's City Hall. And it's another Sunday on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. We love how that all works so smoothly. Erin O'Hare, equity reporter. You can look up her articles on SeavilleTomorrow.org. Erin, let's talk about a major news piece came out recently where Charlottesville's mayor announces not to seek re-election.
Yeah. Gosh, sometimes the days run together. That was what, September? I think that yes, September. In September, Mayor Nakia Walker announced that she will not be seeking re-election for city council. A few months prior, she had said that she felt determined to run again and she was going to do it. But in early September, she changed her mind, decided not to run. And so Mayor Walker has not really given interviews to local press. She's been on radio shows and she's done some live TV things. She's talked to national press. She's talked with Andrea Douglas of the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. And I understand why she, you know, has been hesitant to speak with local reporters. Not all local news outlets have the best track record with, you know, accurately and respectfully representing Black women in positions of power in Charlottesville. And she'd been burned before. So I understood why she didn't want to talk to local reporters, print journalists in particular. But, you know, you always reach out when you have a question for the mayor, because as a reporter, that's your duty. You're like, I got to ask you the question. And I think in our newsroom, we kind of just always understood why she wouldn't respond. But I, myself and my colleague, Charlotte Woods, Charlotte had been talking to Mayor Walker for something. And then the morning that Mayor Walker announced that she would no longer run, she actually reached out to me and asked if I had time to talk. And I thought she was writing me about the future land use map, because I had emailed her about that the night before. And I was like, sure. Turns out she wanted to talk about her decision to drop out of the city council race. We had a really long talk, and it was, you know, she talked about how difficult this has been for her. I mean, it's of course difficult for anyone to be on city council, but you know, as a Black woman in this position of power in the city, just a lot of folks don't understand kind of how that's maybe different from being a white woman or a Black man or a white man or whatever else, on city council. So, yeah, we had a talk about how that decision was difficult for her personally and the responsibility that she still feels toward the community. You know, I obviously don't want to speak for her here. So I think folks who are curious about what she had to say, I would definitely encourage folks to read the story on the website, just, you know, because we worked really hard on framing it properly and accurately and giving the right amount of context. It was actually three of us working for a full day and a half on this in our newsroom. And, you know, we were pretty proud of the context we were able to give.
Well, can I read a section of that?
Yeah.
So, and this is quoted from Mayor Walker. That has been the challenge in this community, that some people who benefit from oppression, white supremacy, racism, pretend that they're not, and other white people uphold that. And Mayor Walker says, I come into every room and I challenge that, whether there are people in that room that agree with me or not. And people have not had to deal with racism at this level that I have forced the community to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
She says what she feels.
She really does.
And I think in politics, not everybody agrees with that. Not everybody is used to that.
Yes, that is absolutely true. I admire that in her, because I do think that she makes herself really vulnerable in that way. And as far as, you know, white folks benefiting from oppression, from white supremacy, racism, and pretending that they're not, or maybe we're not, I should say, because I am white, and other white folks uphold that, I think that's where I see that coming from in the community is, you know, we white folks haven't had to acknowledge that. We can say that, you know, we're not racist, but that's, you know, we still benefit from the system that is, and that's really hard for folks to confront, because maybe you haven't had a great life as a white person, right? Maybe you are, you know, you're poor, you've been homeless, you've had, you know, health issues, whatever it could be. But that doesn't really change the fact that there are really, major ways that we benefit from being white. And I don't know that, that people have been made to reckon with that in the way that Mayor Walker has asked us to. And it's hard. But personally, I do think it's important if we want to move forward and be a more equitable world, as Charlottesville often says it wants to be. So, yeah, got to do a lot of looking in the mirror. And I do think Mayor Walker has held up that mirror for a lot of folks.
Regardless of viewpoints as to supporting her or thankful that she's not seeking re-election, would you say that she's a divisive candidate, or would you use another phrase?
I don't really know quite how to reply to that. In part because I think so many things are divisive, right? And not everyone is going to agree with everything that another person says. Yeah, I don't know that I can really answer that very well.
Do you think she would have been reelected?
I don't know, honestly. I don't know.
Because typically in Charlottesville, and certainly it's not 100%, but it's certainly a very heavy percentage of Democrats who make the final ballot get reelected. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I think those who pay any attention to the Charlottesville, city of Charlottesville political scene, there are quite frequently more Democratic candidates that seek the seat through the primary than actually make the final ballot. Mm-hmm. So that's why I question, do you think she would be reelected? Because she would have to do this in two places.
Sure. Well, and the thing about Mayor Walker, she's not a Democrat. She's an independent. So,
oh, that's right. You know, I interviewed her a number of years ago when she ran the first time. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's an independent. So, you know, she wouldn't get the support of the established Democratic Party. In the way that,
although she did have some established Democrats, at least the first time around, and I think still do, like mm-hmm. former Mayor Dave Norris.
Yes,
gave her a lot of support.
Yeah, and I think that would have happened again. I think there are a lot of, I mean, like any candidate, right? There are folks who would continue to support her, folks who had supported her previously but no longer. And then folks who just would not support her. But it's hard to say. I honestly, sometimes I'm surprised by the elections, 'cause you just never really know, even with trends.
So what was it like getting a breaking news story in a somewhat exclusive manner?
I was shocked, and I was actually really nervous, because that is a lot of trust that she was giving me, at least that's how I understood it. And so just wanting to make sure that I respected that and honored that in our interview. I think some folks might not think that that's a good way to approach reporting, but that's kind of the ethos of how I work. It's like, I honor and respect, you know, the trust that people place in me to represent them accurately, and to be truthful and to not take things out of context. So, I was nervous, but I had wanted to talk to her for a long time because I think she is a very smart woman who makes really great connections and whose insight is valuable to how we understand the broader Charlottesville community and you know, who we are and what we could be. So I did enjoy our conversation, even though it was extremely emotional and, you know, obviously very difficult for her. I hope we get to talk again. but I appreciated very much that she would come to me for that. Yeah.
So on a topic that ties in somewhat, because Mayor Walker regularly had difficult discussions with other leadership members at City Hall, City Manager Chip Boyles recently announced his resignation. And yes. I believe the two of them had had some battles of viewpoint.
Yeah. In the most recent city council meeting, Mayor Walker was asking City Manager Boyles for answers as to why he fired former Charlottesville Police Chief Rochelle Brackney. Mayor Walker hasn't, you know, felt satisfied by his answers. And she's not alone in that. A lot of folks, especially out in the community, feel that way. And so she was asking for answers. She was, you know, pressing for more information so that she could understand it, so that the community could understand it. And that meeting was, I mean, some of these, those planning commission meetings we were talking about, those get contentious, but like this meeting was extremely so. And so Boyles announced his departure about a week after, and he will leave the city manager job on October 29th. And there's just been a lot of City Hall turnover in general, a lot of leadership positions, changing over, either because folks are retiring, people are leaving for personal reasons or professional reasons, or they've been fired. So a lot of turnover at City Hall and in city leadership in the last like 4 or 5 years, which is unusual.
Doesn't it all go back to 2017?
I think a lot of it does. Yeah, I think a lot of it does. But not all, you know, we had problems before that. So
Erin O'Hare, she's a journalist and equity reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow. Erin, we got less than 5 minutes left. So let's jump on one last article and try and squeeze this in. You did and the largest one really that you did the most work on, a 4-piece article you did with a U.S. Army translator, Tony Razul.
Yeah.
Why was that? Why was the need for a 4-piece article?
So I interviewed Tony to try to understand maybe a little bit about what folks who were coming here from Afghanistan, like what they might be going through, right? And I met up with Tony. He came to our office. We sat and just talked, and everything, like I sat down, I transcribed our conversation, and I said to my editor, I was like, I don't know that I can write 1,000 word story out of this. And I was like, it's so much of what he brings up and what he points out, like in his truly expert perspective and experience, is so far out of the realm of what we experience every day here, right? Like I thought that it was a story that many folks in our community and all over the world, turns out, hadn't heard. And there were just so many different components to it that I had talked with my editor, Elliot Robinson, who's now with Virginia Public Media. But we decided that doing it in 4 parts instead of one really long, like 12,000 word story would be more, would be a better reading experience. But we didn't want to cut out, you know, anything important. And turns out everything that he said was important. So
So I'm reading these articles, and there's and I don't want to make light of it because I'm not, but the difficulty in getting his special immigrant visa.
Oh gosh.
And you get a one-on-one, so to speak, story about that. But something that struck me, you have this quote there from him. He's a U.S. Army translator, as I wind time down here. U.S. troops called for more translators. And I was like, I keep sending you translators. And they were like, yeah, as soon as they arrive, they get killed. So we need more translators.
Yeah. Yep. It's so messed up. It's like, you know, Tony knowing pretty much that whoever he sent was likely to die. And he went himself. And the chances that he would also be killed when he got there were very high. So I was also very struck by that, because I was like, I've never had to make a decision like that in my life. And how lucky am I? And Tony had to make those kinds of decisions many times. And there are many people like Tony who've had to make that decision many times throughout their lives. So that was a powerful moment. I didn't know what to say to him. I just sat there and like looked at him and I said, Tony, I don't have words. Please keep talking.
And what is Tony doing now?
Tony works in real estate now. He would love to keep doing translation work, but as I think the fourth part of the series shows, turns out it's not so easy to do that once you arrive in the United States. So even though he had been working for the government, well, for the Army for so long.
One last thing to share with the listeners about Tony you feel is important.
Oh, gosh. I think what Tony would want folks to get out of the story is that, you know, that when we do have people coming into this community, we're about to welcome 250 people from Afghanistan into Charlottesville, that there are ways that we can be good neighbors and help these folks adjust to living here, to being part of our community. Because, you know, Tony, he has said over and over again that he hopes that his story can help us understand what our new neighbors have gone through so that we can be better neighbors to them.
Erin O'Hare with us, equity reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find these articles, including the four different pieces, fascinating, on Tony Razul, U.S. Army translator in Iraqi and Afghanistan. SeavilleTomorrow.org. Erin, thank you so much.
Thank
you. For sharing with us today.
Thanks. I appreciate you asking me to come on.
Folks, we'll be back next Sunday. Please return. See you then.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.